The latest edition of the online Issues Etc. Journal is out. It contains an article I've written titled Legalism and License. How are these two really the same error? Find out with the latest Issues Etc. Journal. You can also read about Pastor Brian Wolfmiller's journey from liberal Lutheranism and navel-gazing evangelicalism to the external promises of God in Holy Scripture. Get your copy of the latest Issues Etc. Journal by sending your name and email address to journal@issuesetc.org.
This bill, for the first time in 30 years, allows for the taxpayer funding of abortions.
When Christians say, I'm not going to get involved in those things, what we've done, we have now not only abdicated responsibility, but we have absolutely given confirmation to the utter destruction of everything we're afraid to touch.
Today we are celebrating the birth of our Prophet Muhammad, who was born on this day. It's a great day of the Muslim world. The Prophet gave us this religion, which is a religion of peace.
It's true that he was a violent man. In fact, he was, if you will say, the first Muslim terrorist.
Southern Illinois truck drivers who love Issues, etc.
You know, there is now an entire realm of communication devoted to pretty much talking about the subject for today's Pastor's Roundtable. Just turn on the radio, spin across the dial, and almost all you will hear, if it's not music, is talk about politics, about government. We, as Americans, are obsessed with our government. We have a system in which we govern by the consent of our government. We talk about ourselves being the government. And then in the same sentence, we'll talk about government as though it's some faraway entity. And of course, we think about government in a particularly American way, which might make it difficult for us to understand the thinking of the 16th century reformers when they thought about political order. They thought about very different things. There was at the time no capitalism. There was at the time no real democracy, not as we know it, not representative government, really. And so they thought and they spoke differently about political order, and yet what they had to say was thoroughly scriptural. We need to realign our thinking on the political order with that of the reformers. We're going to try and do that here in the first hour of Issues, Etc. on this Thursday afternoon, March the 11th, our Pastor's Roundtable on political order based on the apology of the Augsburg Confession. Now, if you would like to win a Concordia edition of the Lutheran Confessions, we're going to be giving one away to the best question or comment on political order during this hour. You can give us a call, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. You can email us, talkback@issuesetc.org. You can Twitter us at @issuesetc, or you can leave a question or a comment at our Facebook page. That's Facebook.com/issuesetc, Facebook.com/issuesetc. Leave a comment there, a question there on political order. We check it during the program. And again, the best question or comment will receive a pocket edition of Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions. In the second hour of the program, we'll spend a little bit of it with Colleen Carroll Campbell talking about the expulsion of the preschool student at a Catholic school in Boulder, Colorado, also Catholic Charities refusing spousal health care coverage in response to same-sex marriage in Washington, D.C. Then we'll spend some time with Pastor Todd Peppercorn, continuing our conversation with him on the penitential Psalms, Psalm 51, to round off these 2 hours of Issues, Etc. Our Pastor's Roundtable is a kind of a crowded one today. Usually we got three of us here. Now we've got four. Joining us from Evansville, Indiana, by phone, where he's pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Dr. Martin Nolan. Marty, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Here in the studio, Pastor Kevin Golden is pastor of Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, Missouri. Kevin, welcome back to you.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
And Pastor Randy Asbury, pastor of Hope Lutheran Church in St. Louis. Randy, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Marty, we need you to set the stage for us, because the politics and the political order of Western Europe in the 16th century is a different animal than anything we think about today in terms of political order. What did they think of when they thought of political order, the 16th century reformers?
The reformers that would be connected to the Augsburg Confession are thinking about the Holy Roman Empire, And that was a rather complex animal. It at the top, it would have the emperor along with the estates, and these would be the representatives of the largest territories, specifically the electors. I believe there were seven of those, and as many other counts and dukes representing territories as well as city councils. And they would meet together often annually in what were known as diets, and they would transact the business of the Holy Roman Empire. And so in some sense, there was a parliamentary law that was being undertaken there. The election of the emperor was by a vote of the seven electors, and there was a lot of backroom dealing in order to accomplish these things. So in many ways, that portion of the Holy Roman Empire at the top was very similar to what we see in the United States in Congress and political parties. On the more local level, though, where you would have, let's say, a duke in charge of his territory, he was more or less the absolute ruler there. And things that he did, unless they impinged on a neighbor, that is another duke, he pretty much ruled absolutely. And so that end of it was, will we say, monarchical or absolute. So it was a mixture of both monarchical and, at least the higher level, some type of democratic organization. And then all this was based on imperial law, which was had been developed over the years. It originated in Rome and was transferred to the West, and was also then being modified by the canon law, which ruled all the territories held by the Pope and the Church. And that's pretty much what the landscape was at the time.
Randy, set the stage for us in terms of the Church's influence, because at the time, the Church was both Church and, in some sense, also state. And the Pope was both spiritual ruler and temporal ruler. What were they facing there?
Well, they were facing the Pope and the bishops and archbishops wanting to have both the spiritual kingdom or spiritual control and governmental control, governmental kingdom. And so what the reformers are trying to do, especially in the Augsburg Confession and after that the Apology, is trying to separate those things. You can see that in other articles, such as the one on bishops, for example. They're trying to say, bishops, no, you're not supposed to be, you know, the mayor of the town or the governor of this area or the duke, as it were. You're supposed to be the spiritual head, sort of thing. So they're trying to take away those tentacles that are going back and forth between the spiritual and the governmental kingdoms or secular kingdoms.
That had to be, I mean, their thinking here, Pastor Golden, had to be kind of radical, because this is what Western Europe had. I mean, they had church and state mixed together, even the emperor having this kind of divine right kind of quality to him. So their thinking in political order must have really seemed subversive, perhaps.
Certainly in the setting in which it was found at that point in time, it would have seemed quite radical and quite even subversive, as you stated, especially since the time of Constantine. But, of course, they were quite aware that prior to Constantine, there was several centuries in which Christianity existed without any temporal power, if you will, being exercised within the church.
All right. What is the basic point they're making, Marty, when they address the issue and why they feel the need to address the issue of political order?
The Augsburg Confession, Article 16, and then its corresponding article in the Apology, is dealing with the Anabaptists, primarily the Anabaptists, who say that the church cannot support any sort of, let's say, Christian state in any way, and the fact that if you're a Christian, you can't hold any office of the state. So you can't be a soldier, you can't be a judge, you can't be involved as a lawyer, you can't contract lawsuits. For another example would be that marriage would be entirely under the church and not under the auspices of the state at all. And this was a teaching of the Anabaptists. It's why the Anabaptists ended up in conflict, and in some cases violent conflict, with not only the emperor but also the Lutherans and the, what they call the magisterial reformers. So in the Article 16, the reformers, the magisterial reformers, are carefully distancing themselves from the Anabaptist error and saying, no, we affirm that God has created government and all these various aspects of the government for our benefit, and Christians can be involved in these and should be involved in these things, and therefore, as we would say today, they should be involved in politics.
So did they have a full-blown understanding, Pastor Asbury, of the way Christians do today about life as citizens? I mean, if they thought of themselves as subjects to an emperor or to a prince, whereas we think of ourselves as the governed who govern ourselves. About 30 seconds here.
Well, we tend to think of ourselves as the ones in charge in our country, and therefore we elect our governor or our president or senators or representatives. I think at the time of the Reformation, they would not have seen themselves as, you know, really governing as much as being subject, being under the Duke, very hierarchical kind of system. They would have understood the Duke is my ruler. I didn't put him there, but I do have to follow his lead.
All right, when we come back from this break, we're going to continue our conversation on political order. Your questions and comments are certainly welcome. We're giving away a copy of the handbook edition of the Lutheran Confessions to the best question or comment during this pastor's roundtable, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-6943. Talk back at issuesetc.org, Twitter us at issuesetc, or leave a message at our Facebook page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Mr. Politician, please don't deceive us, Mr. Politician. Though they're the believers, just how can we tell, Mr. When to... Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Gloria Christi Lutheran, Greeley, Colorado. St. John's Lutheran, Rosemount, Minnesota. Trinity Lutheran, Waltham, Minnesota. Trinity Lutheran, Fredericktown, Missouri. Zion Lutheran, Gravelton, Missouri. Christ the King Lutheran, Billings, Montana. Redeemer Lutheran, Nashville, Tennessee. And Zion Lutheran, Douglas, Wyoming. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. Journal. IssuesETC.org. Click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
Lutheran Radio in Exile. You're listening to Issues Etc.
I attended Sunday services in a beautiful Singapore Lutheran congregation. One local man approached me and asked with a pronounced Southeast Asian accent, "You live in St. Louis? You know Todd Wilkin?"
Pastor Matt Harrison reading from his new audiobook, Christ Have Mercy, How to Put Your Faith in Action.
Who? You mean Todd Wilkin? It turned out this man, half a world away, was a regular listener via the internet, and he's hardly alone. It really is a whole new day. We are witnessing the greatest free flow of faithfully Lutheran information in the history of the Lutheran Church. It is the worldwide moment for confessional Lutheranism. It is Missouri's moment.
You can download Christ Have Mercy by Pastor Matt Harrison at cph.org. It costs only $10.99 to download. This new audiobook is a must-listen for Issues Etc. fans. Christ Have Mercy by Pastor Matt Harrison, cph.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's our Pastor's Roundtable on this Thursday afternoon, March the 11th. We're coming to you live. We're talking about political order, and we're following the order of the Apology of the Augsburg Confession. You can find it at our website, issuesetc.org. Okay, so in a nutshell, we have the reformers who are primarily concerned about responding to the radical reformers who kind of want to overturn all of political order for the kingdom of Christ. What distinction is key that the reformers draw that the radical reformers seem to miss, Pastor Golden?
Surprise, surprise, I'd have to say it all boils down to a right understanding of what the gospel is. And this comes out very clearly in the Apology as the reformers are discussing in what does true Christian perfection, what is it found? Where is that found, true Christian perfection? Is it found in establishing a new governmental order, as Anabaptists would be arguing, or is true Christian perfection found elsewhere? And the reformers end up saying, yes, it's found elsewhere. It's found in the gospel. So from the Apology, we hear Christian perfection is not found in contempt for civil ordinances, but in the inclinations of the heart and profound fear of God and in strong faith. This is where true Christian perfection is found, one's relationship to God via the gospel.
Is it a, Marty, is it a separation of church and state?
Well, not exactly, because he's not. It's not requiring the disestablishment of the Holy Roman Empire. That would probably be something that you could attribute to the Calvinists. It's really how they ended up in the 30 Years' War, because the Calvinists could not abide having a Catholic emperor. They really wanted somebody that was a Calvinist emperor, and this led directly to the 30 Years' War, whereas the Lutherans were willing to do that. They did not really care in that sense who was their president, as we would say today, as long as he gave them the freedom to worship in the way that they felt that they had to do that. And when he didn't do that, for example, during the interim period, then they had difficulties, and there was some protest and refusal to go along with the law of the emperor. But otherwise, they were willing to accept whatever government or officer that was there, and that was that's in synopsis what the Lutheran position was on politics and government.
I think what the reformers are trying to do is steer a course between two extremes. The one extreme of the Anabaptists, on the other hand, they're saying only church. That's the only thing God has given is the church, the spiritual realm. And the Anabaptists are saying that government stuff, that temporal realm, that secular realm, we don't want anything to do with it. Then on the other hand, you have the hierarchical church that they had in that day too, where they were so entrenched in the government realm, bishops ruling kingdoms or parts of the kingdom, that they're trying to separate themselves from that as well. So against the Pope's church of that day, they're trying to say, no, we need to distinguish between the secular realm and the spiritual realm. So on the one hand, the Anabaptists, they have to say, no, there is a secular kingdom given by God. You have to realize that, Anabaptists. And on the other side, with the Pope's church, they're saying, don't confuse them, keep them separate. So I think the Lutherans are trying to walk this fine line between those two extremes.
Does our modern notion of separation of church and state that we usually use to one degree or another, Pastor Golden, as Americans, does it fit with that view that they threading of the needle they were trying to do, or do we need to realign our thinking?
Well, I think on average you have to realign your thinking. I think every person that I talk to about this issue of separation of church and state has a different take on what it actually means. And there's the issue constitutionally for our nation, what it means. Well, that's not really our topic today, but more importantly for us as Christians, that's the big question for us to answer is what does it mean for those two? And I would not say separation of church and state is the best way to go about it, but once again, borrowing some classic language that Lutherans have used, it's about how Christ reigns within our lives, that he does with his left hand, if you will, by temporal authority, keeping order. And then on the other hand, he also rules with his right hand of the gospel through the church, bringing grace and mercy and forgiveness. And this is exactly what Pastor Asbury was just describing for us. So separation of church and state, if it's rightly constructed, could be a helpful way to describe that. But as it is often muddled within our society, doesn't really help us a whole lot.
There's a Pastor Nolan, there's an interesting circumstance here that they note in passing, but I think you need to explain it. And here's the quote from the Apology of the Augsburg Confession. The gospel does not offer new laws about the public state, but commands that we obey present laws, whether they have been framed by heathens or by others. It commands that in this obedience we should exercise love. And then they say something interesting. They say Karlstadt was crazy to impose on us Moses's juridical laws. Who was Karlstadt and where did he get it wrong? So wrong that they felt the need to name his name in this article.
Those people that have seen the most recent movie about Martin Luther, which came out, what was that, 5 years ago now? Karlstadt is the guy that kind of took over Wittenberg and certainly the leadership at Wittenberg University while Luther was up at the Wartburg Castle. And he started putting the Reformation into effect in very practical ways by starting to give the chalice of wine to the laity, and he was probably behind a lot of the destruction of the church art that was there and other things like that. And one of his justification for this was quoting the Old Testament. And then Luther, in response to this, of course, Luther, when he came back, he stopped these things and had a much more moderate reform that was being put in effect. But he wrote in 1525 an essay against the Heavenly Prophets that Karlstadt's position was wrong and that the laws of the Old Testament were only for the Jews. And there's also an essay that he wrote about whether the laws of Moses are binding on Christians. He wrote specifically on that and says, no, they are not. The Ten Commandments are binding because they're universal moral law, but they're not the specific laws of Moses. And so, again, in this statement that you quoted, the Lutherans are distancing themselves from the Anabaptist position.
Okay, so just since the question of the Ten Commandments was raised, Pastor Asbury, what would the 16th century reformers make of Christians today who don't only say, well, we need to have the Ten Commandments displayed on the sides of our courthouses because they form kind of a general foundation, among other things, of our way of thinking about law, but Christians who would go so far as to say, the Ten Commandments are the foundation of American jurisprudence and law. What would they make of that?
What would the reformers make of that? Yeah. I'm not sure I can see that they'd disagree with that much. I think they would say that, okay, the Ten Commandments as natural law certainly undergirds any governmental law, such as you shall not murder. Well, of course, that's going to be ensconced in any governmental law. I think they would make the distinction, though, in saying that this is how you should behave in the secular realm so that you can be a better Christian or get closer to God or something like that.
Pastor Golden, there are a lot of things that were illegal in the 16th century.
Mm-hmm.
And largely based upon the kind of natural law thinking, the thinking about the Ten Commandments that are no longer illegal today. Adultery was illegal in those days. Blasphemy was illegal in those days. And all sorts of other things that we wouldn't even think of outlawing today because mm-hmm. they not necessarily because of the religious connotation, but because you could hardly enforce the laws if this were the case. So it seems, again, like we're a world away from them.
We are. We are a different world than what you find with the reformers, in part because of our society. Once again, also because of this historical setting in which they find themselves, where the church had taken on such a strong role within the temporal authority, so that it became the church setting forth as far as fear of God, reverent attitude towards God, not blaspheming God's name and such, would take that and turn that into a civil law rather than it simply being also a matter of Christian piety.
Pastor Asbury, should blasphemy be illegal? Should adultery be illegal? All these things that the Ten Commandments set forth that the 16th century reformers would have considered, this is just common sense. These things should be illegal. They're bad for society. They're disobedience to God.
Should they be illegal? I think it would be awfully hard to enforce. How would you enforce when somebody is committing blasphemy? Who would you call? Would it be the sheriff or the city police who would come and haul you away for that? And likewise, adultery. How would you enforce that? So I think there is a difference between the Ten Commandments as Moses' law, as the law of God's people, and the natural law. Yes, they flow out of the same source. They're very similar, but they're not exactly the same.
All right. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation on political order. Dr. Martin Nolan, pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana, is our guest. He joins us by phone here in the studio. Pastor Kevin Golden, pastor of Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, and Pastor Randy Asbury, pastor of Hope Lutheran Church in St. Louis. You can join us as well. We're giving away a copy of Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions, the pocket edition, to the best question or comment during this hour. Either leave a question or comment at our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/issuesETC. Or you can Twitter us at issuesETC. You can email us talkback@issuesetc.org. Or just give us a call, 1-877-623-6943. Issues Etc., regular guest Pastor Stephen Parks on why your congregation should join the Issues Etc. 300.
If I could, I'd just like to challenge any Lutheran pastors that are listening to consider becoming one of the congregations that supports Issues Etc. My own congregation is a very small church, and I know it can be difficult to try and budget $1,000 a year to become one of the Issues Etc. 300. But if you're being blessed by this, as I know you are, and if your congregation is being blessed by this, as I know that it is, I submit to bring it to the congregation to prayerfully consider supporting the outreach of Issues Etc., not only here in the United States, but also around the world. Thank you so much for what you do.
Please consider adding the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. to your congregation's mission or advertising budget. Simply go to the support page of our website, issuesetc.org. We're looking for 300 congregations to donate $1,000 to Issues Etc. The Issues Etc. 300.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues Etc.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
During the debate over embryonic stem cell research, we pro-lifers said it's wrong to kill human embryos, and adult stem cell research is where the success is. People like Barack Obama accused us of putting ideology over science. A few years back, California committed $3 billion to fund embryonic stem cells. They should have listened to the Wall Street Journal nearly a decade ago when it said follow the money, because then 13 out of 15 U.S. biotech companies invested in adult stem cells. Now California's quietly diverting the money to adult stem cells to follow the obvious success. Too bad they put ideology over science all these years, killing countless human embryos in the process. Will President Obama get the message?
For more information, visit our website at lifeissues.org and stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
Dear Mr. President, come take a walk with me.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about political order. It's our pastor's roundtable on this Thursday, March the 11th. Let's go to the phones. Chris is calling from Michigan. Hi, Chris.
Yeah, if there was a law against blasphemy, how would it be decided what blasphemy is and who would decide? Would it be subjective or objective?
It's a great question. All right, Marty, since you do know something about the thinking of that time, what were the blasphemy laws at the time, and how was it enforced? Was it a church thing or a state thing?
The Spanish Inquisition. So, I think that's the way how was it enforced, because it was a statement of doctrine and a confession of faith. Definition of blasphemy was not just, as I understand it, not just that you happen to run off of the mouth because your bowling didn't do very well that day. It was usually understood to be some sort of false doctrine,
and it was persistent. And if that was the case, then you were hauled into the, I guess you could go to a confessor and you might get off, but if it was obvious that you were not going to retract, then you were hauled before the church court. And those church courts were the what was called the Holy Office, and that was what we call the Inquisition today. So it was then, it would have to go through their procedures, which to us seem very arcane and, really illegal by our standards. But that's how that would be decided, and it would be on a case-by-case basis to find out, you know, what the guy was saying, whether it was really false doctrine or if he was just, you know, crazy. And some of the people that were executed actually were crazy.
So, but the standard was the would have been the creeds of the church and councils of the church and those kinds of things.
Yeah, those kind of things.
When Luther was when he was called to give an account and then to recant before the Diet of Worms, was he on trial?
Oh yeah, he was immediately on trial. I mean that. Where does that start? I know when he went to Cajetan in Augsburg, that was kind of the early stages of this trial. But I think it happened even before that, when the Pope got wind of what Luther had written in the 95 Theses and how it was a challenge to the very financially beneficial practice of indulgences. The Vicar General in Rome sent a letter or communication to Luther's father confessor, Staupitz, and said, you need to bring this guy in line. So Staupitz did have some talk with him and was not able to convince him. So then at that point, he started going through what we call it dispute resolution or whatever we call it today, that his trial began already at that point. Probably, I'd say, late 1517, early 1518, he was already on trial, early stages of it.
Okay, this is an email from Curtis in Berea, California. It says, do you think that Luther anticipated a time when the church was ever so far removed from the state as it is today? Is it realistic to think that he would have advocated disengagement from politics if Germany was as lost as our government is today? First Pastor Asbury.
Well, to the first question, I don't think he envisioned anything like what we have. He is looking at a situation where the church and the state are combined, where basically the duke, or let's say the governor of the state in our language, would say, here's the religion of my area, my realm. Okay, we'll be Lutherans in this state or Catholics in this state. So I don't think he could separate those all the way. What the apology is trying to do is distinguish them and say one is the temporal power, one's the spiritual power. They're both given by God. That's what the apology is trying to do. So I think Luther would keep them pretty much together like that. I don't think he ever could have foreseen what we have because, first of all, our country is founded on the premise that the government shall not make a law establishing a religion. So that undercuts everything Luther was used to. But now we've taken that and turned it into the separation of church and state, as we call it, and basically that translates into you Christians stay out of politics in our day. So I think it's two totally different worlds.
I completely agree with that, Pastor Asbury. And furthermore, the statement to disengage from politics or from the civil realm, that would not be Luther's actual position. He doesn't suggest that Christians should disengage, but rather it is recognizing that Christians have a foot in two different realms, one as a Christian, part of the church, but then also a Christian ought to be and can rightfully be engaged in the civil realm as well. That would look very different at Luther's day and age than it does in our day and age, but it's not a matter of disengagement. It's about recognizing that when I have two different feet in these two different realms, that I actually am in two different realms rather than mingling the two.
Carrie in Minnesota says, were these dukes, etc., the other nobility, appointed by Rome, or did they inherit their kingdoms? I'm assuming that there was no such thing as elections. Did they stay in power till death? Was there a single king over the territorial leaders, or was that person the Pope? You answered some of that before Pastor Nolan, but if you would, how did the, you said the emperor was elected by the electors. How did the princes and the electors and the various other nobility get their authority and their powers?
Most of the passing of office was by dynastic principles, which meant that fathers would pass to their oldest son unless the oldest son was an imbecile, and which was the case in some cases. But so the dukes would pass on their power usually at their death to their sons and then to the next sons. There were some cases where this was contested, and then, for example, which branch of the family should get it, especially if there was an extinction of one line of the family. And in those cases, then the diet would take over, or the emperor would make a ruling. And sometimes even the pope would step in, because it was part of the larger empire, and they were all interested in who was going to be taking over. But generally, it was on dynastic principles. The emperor was elected, but after Charles V, pretty much the Habsburgs were always the ones that got the imperial role. And in the case of the church, all the church properties, for example, there is the Archbishopric of Salzburg, and that would be not by dynasty because the archbishop doesn't have children, and so that would be by election either of the pope or of the bishops that are local, and so that would be by an election inside the church itself.
Tony in Rhode Island says, I've heard some credit Luther's theology as the philosophical seedbed for the eventual development of constitutional government and the disestablishment of state churches. The argument is based on Luther's articulation of the two kingdoms, the left-hand kingdom and the right-hand kingdom. We've talked a little bit about that. And what God's word alone that God's word alone has ultimate jurisdiction over the conscience. In the mid-17th century, Samuel Rutherford developed Luther's thinking in his treatise Lex Rex, The Law is King. That is, the external law has ultimate jurisdiction even over the king, or so the thinking goes. Have you heard of this, and what are your thoughts? Let's start with you, Pastor Golden.
I am completely unfamiliar with Lex Rex as far as an actual argument on this matter, so I can't really comment on that issue. I am familiar, or at least have come across the argument that Luther's description of the kingdom of the right, kingdom of the left, that has been credited with the development of constitutional government. That's a good historical argument to make. And to be honest, I don't know the history well enough to be able to comment on that specifically.
Here's an email from Chris in Nashville, Tennessee. Chris says, as Christian voters, how much weight should we put on which religious background a candidate comes from? Should we lean toward voting for a Christian candidate, even if they are, say, premillennial or dispensationalist? Or should we vote for the candidate that we believe will rule the wisest? Pastor Asbury.
I guess I would go with the latter. Latter part of the question there. We should vote for and support candidates and even policies and take part in the government for the good of all the people, whatever their religion, whatever their beliefs in society. Now, that's not compromising our beliefs. That's simply, you know, governing and loving our neighbor. And so if we're going to go into the polling place, into the voting booth, and say, okay, is he a Christian or not, I'm not sure that's the best basis to use for voting for a candidate. You might want to look at some of the other views as well. I'm going from just memory here. I don't have an exact quote in my mind, but it seems Luther said something about he'd much rather have a Turkish emperor than, you know, who knew how to govern well than a Christian who didn't govern well, or something to that effect.
It's kind of the same thing. If my car is broken down, I'm going to choose a mechanic to work upon my car. My number one concern is who is going to handle my car well. If they happen to be a Christian, great. But an unbeliever who works in my car and is very skilled at it is preferable to a Christian who might work on my car but really doesn't know what he's doing with my car, what he's doing under the hood. And so same thing also when it comes to the government. I want to choose a candidate based upon, are they going to govern effectively, stand firm on important issues that they're going to take the proper stance, rather than are they a Christian?
Okay, when we come back, you open the can of worms, Pastor Asbury, the wise Turk quote, which is difficult to find. but it's often attributed to Luther. I want to hear from Marty if he knows whether or not Luther actually said, I would prefer a wise Turk as to a foolish Christian, or something to the effect. Or does it reflect Luther's thinking and the thinking of the reformers when they put together the apology of the Augsburg Confession? We're talking about political order when we come back, more with our Pastor's Roundtable.
Wouldn't it be great if more of your fellow parishioners listened to Issues Etc.? Well, here's an easy way for you to publicize Issues Etc. at your church. Go to the support page of our website, issuesetc.org, and you'll find a short paragraph to include in your weekly church bulletin. Copy and paste the text for your church secretary or pastor to include each week in the Sunday bulletin. The bulletin blurb is updated weekly, issuesetc.org. Stay connected, issuesetc.org.
Historic liturgy, cool. Liturgical dance, not cool. Kneeling for the Lord's body and blood on a Sunday morning, cool. Sitting in your theater-style seat with cup holder for your double mocha latte, not cool. We're the Brothers of John the Steadfast. If you're interested in traditional Lutheran doctrine and practice, check us out. www.steadfastlutherans.com.
We're not funded by LCMS, Inc. You're listening to Issues Etc.
In 1521, at the Diet of Worms, Martin Luther was asked to recant his writings. Luther responded, "Unless I am convinced from the sacred scriptures that I am in error, I cannot and will not recant. Here I stand. I cannot do otherwise. God help me. Amen." Will you stand with us as we proclaim these Reformation truths in the 21st century? You can take your stand by becoming a monthly or annual contributor to Issues Etc. To find out how you can become an Issues Etc. confessor, apologist, reformer, or patron, check out the donate page of our website, issuesetc.org. Just look for the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses. Help us proclaim the solas of the Reformation, Scripture, faith, grace, and Christ alone. Here we stand, Issues Etc., and you.
Politician, can you make a right decision for all of us?
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking about political order. It's our Pastor's Roundtable on this Thursday, March the 11th. Our email address here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org. Twitter us at issuesetc. Leave a message for us at our Facebook page, facebook.com/issuesetc, or give us a call, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Now, Marty, Randy raised the question of the Wise Turk quote, and I have yet to find this solidly attributed to Luther. It's often attributed to him in a casual way. Do we know if Luther ever said such a thing? And perhaps more importantly, does it reflect Luther and the Reformers' thinking as to, say, the religious affiliation, we would call it today, of their leaders?
Well, I'm with you, Todd. I'm not sure that I've ever run across it. And I've read almost all of Luther's works that are not the commentaries in English. So at least once I've read through that. So that doesn't mean it's not there, but I don't ever remember coming across that. Across that particular quote. If you want a general essay that is perhaps covers all this in more detail than just the apology, it would be the essay, Secular Authority, to What Extent It Should Be Obeyed. And this has been in several translations. I think it's also in the American edition, published in 1523. So there it really talks about the responsibility of Christian princes, and I think he would have preferred to have a Christian prince just because when you see how he talks about the issues that they're dealing with in Saxony with the Jews, one of the problems is the Jews want to follow their own laws, and well, that doesn't work because you have imperial law and the Jewish law, and the two don't
don't work together. I mean, there is some overlap, but there's a lot of conflict, too. So I think he would have preferred, for the sake of the church, to have a Christian prince that understands Christian law and Christian principles behind it. But I think, yeah, I mean, if you want to put a hypothetical case and say that, you know, the choices are, you know, a complete idiot who is nominally a Christian and baptized, and then you have this wise gentleman that's like Solomon, that's of another religion, well, I think then he would say, well, yeah, we need this guy to know what he's doing or everything's going to be in chaos. And that's really the whole point of the government, is it's to provide order and peace. And if the ruler can't do that, let's go look for somebody else.
Okay, so we're going to take the Wise Turk quote from Luther and put it in the same category provisionally as the alleged Billy Graham quote that called the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod the sleeping giant.
Apocrypha or urban myths.
Yes.
Okay. So I apologize for bringing in
that's
the urban
myths. That's all right. Until Marty's scholarship can prove otherwise, we'll call it apocryphal along with the Billy Graham quote about the sleeping giant LCMS. All right. Let's see. Mike in Los Alamos, New Mexico, leaves a message on Facebook saying, so as Christians, are we to respect the rule of law given that the secular kingdom belongs to God and he has instituted it in his providence? Likewise, it seems, if God has given us a form of government where the governed are responsible for the content of the laws, then we as Christians should not disparage or shun participation in the civil realm. He speaks directly to our American situation. Pastor Asbury.
I'd say yes. Yeah, we should take part in our governance because we as Christians can bring, you know, good order, respect for neighbor, respect for life into our system of law, and we can use good Christian morals, if you will, to enforce the laws, do things fairly, do it for the benefit of our neighbor, the weak and the poor, you name it. Yes, so I would agree with those statements that, yes, we should be involved because we can, one, elect our leaders, but also, two, help shape how the laws work, how society works itself around them.
I agree with that, and I'd also nuance one point that was brought up within the question from the individual on Facebook regarding the matter of respecting the civil authority, and yes, we are to do that, but there is one proviso that we always put upon this. This comes up in the apology also, that we are to be submissive and obedient to the secular authority unless it goes clearly against God's word. Then we are bound to disobey the secular authority because we must obey God rather than man.
I've got something I want to talk about participation in politics, and that is generally, at least in America, politics are dictated by interests or interest groups, and usually you're seeking your own personal interest. You know, so the parties that have developed over the years put together various interest. There's a business interest on one party, there's a labor interest on the other. And if you're, so for example, if you're a farmer, you're going to looking after a farmer's interest and you'll gravitate to the party that has those interests. Well, the thing is about the apology, it says that when we're involved in the politics, that it says, well, for example, to obey the existing law and in this obedience to practice love, that seems to me to put the Christian in a different position when they are involved in politics. In other words, they're not going after their own self-interest. They're exercising love for the, what you say, the common good or their neighbor. And that means sometimes they may be comfortable with one platform or one policy, and the other time they're comfortable with something else. So it's difficult maybe for Christians to work in our current party setting that is concentrates on interests.
Okay, this is from Steve in Rochester, Minnesota, via Facebook. He says, the Book of Concord states that the administrative apparatus of the church and the civil government are separate, and we Lutherans use the phrases kingdom of the left hand, kingdom of the right hand. Both of these hands in both of these kingdoms are Christ's. The distinction between right and wrong flows from God's character and is not arbitrary. Given these propositions, I have some questions. We can get to just one of them. He says, is it not permissible to distinguish further within these confessional bounds as long as no binding of consciences is involved? That is, if we can distinguish between the office of the public ministry and the commissioned ministry and the laity, May we not also distinguish between the civil government proper, the families, schools, and various voluntary organizations, for while they have some characteristics in common, they do not have all characteristics in common. Your thoughts there, Randy?
It sounds to me like he's saying, can't we make these distinctions? Well, of course we can. They're already there. We're just admitting what's there if we're saying, well, the office of the ministry is different from laity, unless I'm missing something in
his
question.
Well, is he really asking about vocation and how it relates to how we understand political order? Various vocations. Oh,
okay, yeah, various vocations, yes. Our vocation as citizen is to see this distinction between God's temporal realm and God's spiritual realm, the church and the state, so to speak. So if that's what he's getting at, yes, we would agree with that, we're here talking about the vocation.
Okay, finally to you, Pastor Golden. In the end, what was the ultimate concern of the 16th century reformers when they addressed the issue of political order? Did they believe ultimately that the gospel and its free reign was at stake?
Well, certainly when it comes to the government, there is a recognition that the government could be subversive to the gospel, and that is but at the end, it is not the government upon which the gospel depends. The gospel is that which the church proclaims, the church that which rules the church as well, and so it's not the government upon which we depend for the sake of the gospel. And so, for example, within the Apology, it's stated the gospel does not make laws concerning the civil realm, but is instead the forgiveness of sins and the beginning of eternal life in the hearts of believers. Therefore, yes, we need order. And such coming from the civil realm so that the gospel might go forth, but it is not the job of the civil realm to push forth the gospel. That is the church's calling.
Pastor Kevin Golden is pastor of Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, Missouri. Kevin, thanks for coming over.
It's good to be here as always.
Pastor Randy Asbury is pastor of Hope Lutheran Church in St. Louis. Thanks for coming over.
You bet. Thank you.
And Pastor Martin Noland is pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana. It's always a pleasure, Marty. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for the invitation.
All right, this is going to be a tough one because we had a lot of good questions put out there. I think Curtis in California is going to get the copy of Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions, for his question. I can't remember if he emailed it or if it was via Facebook, but thanks to everybody who submitted questions and comments for our Pastor's Roundtable on political order as well. Now, if you will email us, Curtis in California, with your mailing address, talkback@issuesetc.org, we will send out to you a copy of Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions. And again, thanks to everybody who contributed questions and comments. When we come back, it's hour two of Issues Etc. We're going to spend that hour first with Colleen Carol Campbell talking about that preschooler that got expelled in Boulder, Colorado, because the parents of that preschooler were gay. We'll get her reaction to it. Also, we'll talk about Catholic Charities in Washington, D.C., deciding to drop spousal health care coverage in response to same-sex marriage. Then Pastor Todd Peppercorn joins us in hour two. We'll continue our series with him on the penitential psalms today. We'll deal with a famous penitential psalm, Psalm 51, that's coming up in hour two of Issues Etc. God has given us this great gift of political order, which, because we are the agents by which it is enacted, works really bad, but it is still a good gift. Good government in the hands of sinners does an awful lot of bad things, but we must remember from whom it comes, our good God, for Christ's sake. When we come back, hour two of Issues Etc., I'm Todd Wilkin.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.